Hello, and welcome to the Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine podcast series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. For this episode, we reach back into our archives to the April 1969 issue for the story The First Day of Spring by Howell Hirst. The story dramatizes a timeless dilemma facing kids and adults, bullying and violence. More than 40 years after the story's publication, Mr. Hirst is turning it into a feature-length film, also called The First Day of Spring, and set in the present. Mr. Hirst reads the story and answers some questions we had about the creative process of translating a short story into film.
Blue grew to be Bobby's favorite color during the winter. Before, it had been green, but he changed his mind and it was blue, probably because the grass and trees were covered by snow, and the blue skies on clear days was the only color to be seen. Even when it was a pale gray and almost white like the snow and ice on the ponds and lakes, the sky gave a cold blue feel to everything. Today was a special day. Not a big special day like a trip to the lake or a picnic at Grandma's and Grandpa's, but Bobby was still excited about it. All winter long he had been working on an aluminum letter opener in Mr. Powell's metalworking class at school, and today was the day when everyone turned in his project for grading. At the end of the hour, Mr. Powell would show the best three works from the class. Crunching through the snow to school, Bobby thought about his letter opener and the time he had spent on it with a file, emery cloth, and steel wool. The aluminum was soft and easy to work with, but he'd had to be careful not to file too much or tiny nicks appeared which marred the finish. He had used steel wool many hours longer than necessary because he was afraid of going too far with the emery cloth and scratching the metal too deeply. Now the small, thin aluminum opener was smooth and graceful. Nevertheless, he was anxious about a possible flaw he hadn't seen, which Mr. Powell might find. He stopped once on his way to school to watch some birds gingerly hopping about the base of a tree. They seemed remarkably alive and spry, and Bobby wondered whether they had just come back from some wonderful and warm home miles and miles away. Before he left, he bent down, opened his sack, and broke a peanut butter sandwich into crumbs which he spread out on the snow. As he walked away under the trees, his feet made funny noises in the snow, like when the dentist tapped silver in his teeth. First period, Ms. Pinkerton rasped at the class about verbs and nouns while she drew strange diagrams on the blackboard. She was such an unlovely person. Brusque, with a forceful manner that made her seem much like a man. Her stride was long and ungainly, and she stamped her foot when the class didn't pay attention. Henderson, what word does softly modify in this sentence?
Modify, Miss Pinkerton?
Yes, modify. We went through all of this yesterday when we started discussing adverbs. There are some words which modify verbs. Words which are similar to verbs, but different in form. Look, just make a choice. Does softly modify stroked or hair in this sentence? Martin Henderson looked first at the blackboard and then at Ms. Pinkerton, then back at the blackboard. He had no idea what Ms. Pinkerton was talking about. The words, scraggly written on horizontal and diagonal lines and in parentheses, were somehow supposed to make a sentence. This he knew, but why were they written all over the place? All he could see was a white centipede on a black background. He bit his grease-stained fingernails. Well, Henderson?
Don't know, ma'am.
What?
I don't know, ma'am. I told you softly is an adverb, and it modifies a verb. You have a choice of two words, stroked or hair. Which word is a verb?
The boy sat looking at the teacher with no change of expression. Bobby saw his hand reach for his shirt pocket, then drop back to his desk. He knew Martin had reached for a cigarette before remembering where he was.
Ms. Pinkerton's foot crashed to the floor. "Henderson, I've not only explained this to the class and individually in class to you, but you and I have met after school 2 hours, and you still don't know what a verb is, let alone an adverb. If you don't get to work and learn what they are, it will be my duty to fail you and try to teach you the same material next year. Believe me, it is not a task I would look forward to, but if I have to do it, I most certainly shall." Bobby's face grew hot and red. He felt sick as Ms. Pinkerton continued her tirade. Martin Henderson was a mean boy, he knew, and once had kicked a kitten through a large puddle in front of the school while all the girls watched and screamed at him. He was always fighting someone, usually with 2 or 3 other guys from his neighborhood. Still, Bobby felt embarrassed for him, and sorry. All Martin wanted was to get out of school as soon as possible and to work in his father's garage. Miss Pinkerton should know that. Martin had once written a class paper about his father's garage, which he would take over some day. If that's what he wanted, why should Miss Pinkerton threaten him with more school? And in front of the class, while, "What about you, Clayton?" Bobby looked up. Miss Pinkerton was talking to him. "Do you know the answer?" "I can guess, Ms. Pinkerton, but I'm not sure." "All right, guess then. If you are wrong, perhaps the third student will be able to determine the answer from the one word that's left." "I think softly modifies stroked." "Yes, it does. Softly does modify stroked. Did you hear, Henderson? Softly is an adverb that modifies the verb stroked." Martin nodded at Ms. Pinkerton and glared briefly at Bobby, who wished he had answered wrong. But now it was too late. Bobby knew Martin felt bad, and he was sorry to have been called on by Ms. Pinkerton. As he watched her continue the lesson, he felt also how much he disliked, perhaps even hated, her. It was bad to dislike someone, especially your teacher, even when she seemed so cruel and thoughtless. Bobby knew he couldn't help how he felt about her. How much it hurt, though, he thought, to dislike another person. Bobby went directly from English class to shop, where he climbed to the top tier of bleacher-like desks and sat down. Other boys started drifting on one by one, then groups came, filling the room. There was a splendid hubbub among the boys, with lots of yelling and horseplay. Everyone seemed in a grand mood. Nevertheless, the boys quieted down immediately when Mr. Powell came into the room a few minutes later. Mr. Powell was a big man, topped by a shock of red hair over large freckled jowls and a thick neck. He wore brightly printed ties against pastel shirts which matched his socks. Despite his bulk, he moved lightly on his feet, especially when there was a row in the classroom or something went wrong at a machine. Then he was a kaleidoscope in motion, separating two boys by the scruff of their necks, holding them at double arm's length while determining the cause of the fight, or rushing to a lathe to disengage a bit, or, what he feared most, a shirt sleeve. He had been a sergeant in the Army for many years before he started teaching. Although his voice was strong and tinged with a light Carolina drawl, he never spoke loudly, but formed his words slowly and carefully, enunciating every word like, Bobby thought, a radio commentator. Today, he too was in a particularly good mood. "All right, gentlemen, let us see what you have done over the past weeks. Come down a row at a time and leave your projects on my workbench. Make sure they are tagged with your names. As soon as you've turned in yours, go clean up all tools and machines. Let us make a field day out of it. I want to see this place spotless at the end of the hour." The boys filed down, passing by Mr. Powell's bench on their way to the tool bin. Bobby sat at his desk watching as each boy put down his project. The variety of objects placed on Mr. Powell's bench amazed him. There were car jacks, spreaders, C-clamps, ashtrays, lamp bases, dozens of projects which seemed much more intricate and complicated than his letter opener. When his term came, though, one object caught his eye. Lying on Mr. Powell's bench, glistening among the other things,
was a long steel scimitar-bladed letter opener which some boy had chromed. It shone brilliantly in the sun, falling from the high windows of the shoproom. The tag read, "Martin Henderson." Bobby walked stunned to the lathe assigned to him and started cleaning it. How could his simple aluminum letter opener possibly compete with Martin's chromed one? Even among the other more complicated gadgets, Martin's gleaming blade stood out as the most striking object on the bench. Bobby thought himself foolish to have hoped he could come in first. Suddenly he felt nervous. His forehead and hands were damp. Hesitantly approached Mr. Powell, who was engrossed in his inspection, looking first at a deeply blued hammerhead and then slowly turning a nut over the fine thread of a bolt. "Mr. Powell, sir, may I have permission to go to the bathroom?" Without looking up, Powell asked, "Do you have a note from the doctor?" "No, sir." "You know the rules, young man. If you do not have a note from a doctor saying you're taking medicine, you cannot go to the bathroom during shop period. You have a full 10 minutes between classes, and that ought to be time enough for anyone. I cannot have the whole class filing in and out all hours. I would never be able to keep track of all you ornery characters." "Yes, sir, I know, but I really need to go. Honest, I don't want to play in the halls or anything. I'll go and come right back, sir." Mr. Powell turned from his work to look into Bobby's eyes. "Oh, it's you, Bobby. What's the matter? Did you drink too much water before class or have an extra hot chocolate at breakfast?" "I guess so, sir. I don't know. I just need to go. Really?" "Oh, okay, boy. But listen, you run up to your desk and get a piece of paper and fold it up like a note, then bring it down here for me to look at. We don't want the other fellows to think I'm doing you favors, do we?" Bobby scampered to his desk and rummaged through his satchel until he found a sheet covered with writing. Mr. Powell watched him take out the sheet, fold it over twice, and return to the workbench. Bobby stood silently before him while he pretended to read it. "All right then, son. You go on now. Don't mention this, though, or I'll have everybody all over me and you for making an exception to the rules." "Oh, no, sir, I won't say anything, I promise. And thank you, sir. I'll be right back." Bobby started to go, but Mr. Powell held him by the arm. He turned back, afraid that Mr. Powell had changed his mind. Mr. Powell looked at him silently for a moment, then mussed his hair with his hand and said, "God, you're a good boy, son. I wish I had a whole roomful like you." Bobby looked down at the floor and then at Mr. Powell, who returned his gaze for only a second before dropping his hand from the boy's arm and returning to his work. Just before the end of the hour, Mr. Powell called all the boys back to their seats. The table full of projects was beside him. He waited for the boys to quiet down before speaking. "Your projects are good. I'm pleased with your work. I feel most of you worked hard and often attempted more than you should have with remarkable success. It was difficult for me to choose the best three works, but I've tried to be as fair as possible. If you have any questions about my choices, please see me after class." Mr. Powell then quickly showed the boys the lamp, a set of andirons, and a large serving tray. He presented each work as a well-thought-out project. Boys groaned as they realized their works had not won, and comments were passed among clusters of boys perched at various levels on the bleachers. The bell broke up the talk, though, sending everyone rushing for his project and off to the next class. Martin Henderson and Bobby were the last two to pick up their work. Martin was openly mad at the decisions made by Mr. Powell and was arguing as Bobby came to the workbench. "I don't think you were fair at all. My letter opener is not as big as lots of the other fellows' things, but it's strong and works good. Besides that, it's the only thing that's been chromed. It's shinier than anything else that was here. Don't that mean anything? Look at the difference between it and Bobby's." "Martin, I have looked at the difference between it and Bobby's," Powell said. "As a matter of fact, I almost included Bobby's project in the top three. It's small and simple, but it's as perfect as it could be. Bobby spent many hours on it, I can tell. He did everything by hand. It may not be shiny like yours, but its shape and finish all come from hard work. Your letter opener is shiny not because you polished and buffed it, but because you covered up a rough finish with a chrome plating. You must admit, it was the quick and easy way to finish your work. But I don't see what difference it makes, Martin continued. Mine looks better than his. It is better. Mr. Powell took a deep breath, hesitated an instant, let it out, and sat down. Martin took his letter opener from the bench and stormed from the room. For a moment, Bobby watched Mr. Powell, then left the room without saying anything. In the hallway, after shop, Bobby jostled against the other students as he changed books at his locker, put his lunch sack on the top shelf, and tossed his boots on the floor among scattered sheets of notebook paper. Connie Barton raced by with two boys hot in pursuit, throwing spitballs. Connie yelled at him, "Game tomorrow if the court's not too wet. Bring both your rackets. Mine's broke." Bobby smiled as Connie dodged a girl in the hallway and rounded the corner, but then quickly reappeared, catching his two followers square in the face with spitballs he'd saved. Then all three tore off again. The bell was ringing, just as Bobby got to music class. He sat down quickly. As she always did on Monday morning, Ms. Towers started playing the piano. What she played first thing Monday contained what she wanted to explain during the week. The music was bright this morning, with lots of trills and runs. It seemed fitting enough, for although the ice was not yet melting, the sun was peeking out from the clouds. The period passed easily. On his way home that afternoon, Bobby slushed through the woods, kicking soft chunks of melting snow against the trees. His jacket was unbuttoned, and his sweater was tied around his waist. The air was a funny mixture of warm and cool as the sun came through the bare tree branches, which were playing with a light breeze. Martin was waiting for him with two of his friends down by the creek where the rope swing hung from the old oak tree. No one said anything. The two boys grabbed Bobby and held him while Martin smashed him in the face with his fist. Bobby's nose started bleeding. Hot blood filled his mouth and tears blinded him. He kicked free from the two boys, flailing his arms and grabbing for Martin. They came together, fell to the ground, and rolled down the muddy bank to the creek's edge. Bobby started to pull himself free as soon as they stopped rolling, but Martin clung to him, pulling his hair and wrapping his legs around him. Bobby's clothes were soaked in snow and mud, and he felt very cold. Fire suddenly burned his insides, and he was filled with pain. His hands would not follow his command. They lost their grasp of Martin's jacket, and he fell back into the creek, twisting to catch his balance. The water was icy. How could he be so cold in the water, he thought, and yet burn so much inside? The bright afternoon sun sparkled on the water and gleamed off the handle of the slender, shiny blade piercing his jacket and side under his left arm. Martin scrambled to the top of the bank before he looked back with almost the hint of a question in his eyes. Then he ran off after the other boys. Bobby lay on his back in a side eddy of the creek, his head gently digging at the sandbank and the slow-lapping water. His side no longer burned, but he sensed a deep weakness overcoming him. He felt he was melting away and flowing into the water of the creek. The sun above him seemed to grow larger and brighter until it filled the sky with an intense golden light. As his eyes closed, he wondered if the birds had eaten all the crumbs from his peanut butter sandwich. Later, at that time when it is no longer day and has not become night, the birds sang and the day cooled and the evening air came into his empty room at home. Across from his window, lamps were lit and suppers prepared. people came home in twos and threes and alone. And overhead, above them all, the few small, dark, leftover clouds of what had been winter drifted ever so slowly away, and the sky stilled, paled, and grew blue.
Thank you, Hal, for that reading of The First Day of Spring. I'd like to ask you, what compelled you to turn the story into a film?
My motivation to turn the story into a film for today's audience is that the subject of violence is equally as valid today as it was 40 years ago. Humanity's overriding fault is its inability to avoid violence as a futile solution to disagreements among one another. We see it at an adult level in terrorist attacks and large nations' dependence, such as our own, on massively expensive military establishments. I believe the subject deserves far deeper introspection and discussion.
Who do you see as the audience for the film?
The film's primary audience is middle school and high school students, their adult teachers, and their parents and relatives. As a matter of fact, the marketing campaign being designed focuses on using teachers to introduce the film to their students and parents. It will be the basis for a school lesson plan about violence, ethics, and the importance of solving difficult issues as rationally and as peacefully as possible.
Can you tell us about the process of turning a short story into a film? What were some of the creative choices and compromises that you had to make?
The primary choice I had to make, turning the short story into a film, was whether to have the main character live or die. I chose for him to live so that both he and his adversary can learn from their mutual experience in violence. Of course, I had to create a more complex story to fill 2 hours of film time, and that opened up new ideas for me to incorporate into the film to possibly help explain how violence can erupt from what may seem the most peaceful-appearing situations, such as a high school. Actually, I tried not to compromise the story. It attempts to demonstrate the innate maturity of youth and the developed immaturity of adults. As we all grow up, we make compromises to accept the frailties of human beings, often denying our really tangible capability to make truly ethical and moral decisions. We select too often, even to the point of making it national policy, the use of violence instead of peaceful means to solve human differences and reduce the often deadly effects of our fragile emotional weaknesses. The hardest thing I faced was how to say something to help us all think deeply about violence while making the story really interesting. After all, as fiction, I know it has to entertain people. They have to like the story and feel a resolution at its end. I may have accomplished that. I hope so.
Hal, thank you very much for reading the story for us, and good luck with the film. This podcast was produced with the help of our assistant editor, Jackie Sherbo. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is a monthly magazine of original mystery and crime fiction. To learn more about us, we urge you to go to our website, www.themysteryplace.com. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital versions are now available from Amazon, Apple, Barnes & Noble, FictionWise, Google, Magster, Sony, and Zinio. We also encourage you to visit our Facebook page and our new blog, Trace Evidence, at trace-evidence.net. Thank you for tuning in.